Welcome to the Lion's Mane Podcast, episode 26. Today we're going to talk all about meditation, mindfulness, and acceptance, and why that's important for sports performance, but also for life, especially in March 2020 when coronavirus is ravaging the globe at the moment. Today we're joined by Paula Schlüter, who is a sports psychologist out of Leipzig, Germany, to talk all about meditation. So without further ado, let's go. I'm so happy that you're here. Thanks for coming. Please tell us who you are.
Thanks for having me. My name is Paul. I'm a sports psychologist and online coach, mostly in powerlifting. I've lived all over the world. In case you can't place my accent, that's because there's no place for my accent. I've been self-employed full-time since last year. And I'm looking forward to having a little chat about mindfulness with you.
Yeah, so I'm pumped that you're here and there's nobody else I'd want to do it with because we worked so much together on mindfulness and meditation.
Oh, yes.
In 2019, we started the process of building translating a U.S. curriculum into German for athletes and normal people, but we're in the sports psychology world. So working with athletes on MSPE or essentially mindfulness sports performance enhancement training. Yep. And COVID has taken a bit of a, well, the holidays took a bit of a toll on that and delayed it. And COVID is going to give us time to maybe actually finish. So yes. Stay tuned for that. I want to start with this phrase and definition and let you go run away with it. Jon Kabat-Zinn, who is a world-renowned mindfulness researcher, said...
My man.
Exactly. Love him. Mindfulness is paying attention in a particular way and on purpose in the present moment and non-judgmentally. And when I say that to people for the first time, that that's what our goal is, it makes no sense. So could you kind of break down what that looks like, firstly, generally speaking, and then also for athletes? Like, why would that matter at all?
Okay, so the one thing that always... annoys me a little bit about that quote is like paying attention in a particular way. Like, what particular way? Come on, yeah. John. Please be a little bit more specific. But the two factors are the three factors are one, paying attention as a skill that we can practice, paying attention to the present moment, especially in sports, is super important because performance doesn't happen 5 minutes ago. It doesn't happen tomorrow. It happens right now. Mm-hmm. Being non-judgmental, which you can also train or practice as a skill. So that means basically being able to perceive things, whether that's emotions, feelings, or bodily sensations, without categorizing them as positive or negative, so that you're able to basically, I mean, it's sort of an economic approach to sports performance because we're basing our performance on a situation where we always have limited cognitive resources. And when we are mindful, so when we're present in the current moment, or paying attention in a particular way in the present moment, without judging things, that means that we have more cognitive resources to focus on the task that we're doing. I think that's sort of the most relevant application that we have for mindfulness in sports, is that you're, whatever situation you're in, whether that's at a powerlifting meet or in the soccer field, the baseball field, whatever, there's always things going on around you that might distract you in some way. Could be emotions, could be thoughts, could be bodily sensations. And being able to accept those as part of your situation while still maintaining focus on the things that you're supposed to do or on your current moment goals is, I think, a very, very good approach to performance because it just literally helps you give your best in that very moment.
Yeah. So let's go over some of those distractions in sport. I know there's some people who don't talk to themselves in their head constantly and don't have a running commentary. I don't know them. I'm not friends with any of them. So they're certainly not people that I hang out with.
Okay.
But the self-talk is one thing that can get in the way. Stress. What are some other things in sports performance that would distract from the present moment and take up that mental real estate, like you said?
Oh, just like interactions with other people that are around you. maybe things happening that weren't planned or accounted for, that weren't prepared for, maybe situations you're not equipped to deal with appropriately. I mean, that could be anything from, I don't know, like I had an athlete at the last powerlifting meet that I was handling, where she was supposed to go out on her third attempt deadlift. So that's like, for everyone who doesn't know, basically the third attempt deadlift is the very last attempt in the competition. And it's usually the one that's sort of the one of the more mental taxing ones. Mm-hmm. And so she was getting all ready to go out on the platform, and then the bar was loaded, and then they called her out, and then they told her to go back because the bar wasn't loaded properly. And then there was some confusion because the computer system was down. And then they did, all of a sudden they didn't know which weight was supposed to be loaded on the bar. And I was trying to like shout, be like, it's 142 and a half.
Yeah.
Everyone was just looking around because the spotters didn't say, because they were from the Czech Republic. So it's just a mess. And I think those are pretty much the most critical situations. Where mindfulness can be a hugely important tool, because you're able to then not to be distracted by all that stuff going on and just focusing on what you need to do in that right moment.
Yeah. So those moments of serious stress, mental tax, that also tend to mean the most. So for us in soccer, that would be penalty kicks or, not overthinking before cracking a shot, or in goal during penalty kicks. For goalkeepers, we overlook that a lot. But what about an everyday life? What would be some of the things that take us away from this just attention and acceptance in everyday life? Now, COVID is a different situation, but we can talk about that.
I mean, let's talk about home office stuff, right?
Because I'm guessing
at least some of the people listening will still be working. So I'm a very bad example of this, actually, when I work. I'm terrible at working mindfully. Working mindfully, technically, is super efficient because you're getting things done one at a time and you're doing them really well. So I'm the type of person that sits here and I've got my work WhatsApp open. I've got my private WhatsApp open. I've got Instagram on my phone. And I've got at least 8 different tabs in my browser with music running in the background, plus emails. And there have been times where, especially on like a stressful day, and I think there's a weird inverse relationship between the need to be mindful and the amount of stress that you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. So the more stress you're experiencing, the more you need to actually be like the lower your cognitive resources available, the more you need to be mindful to be able to distribute them effectively.
Which is totally counterintuitive, because the story we tell ourselves is I need to work faster and get more things done because I'm overloaded. No.
It could even be things like, I don't know, driving in traffic and not getting upset at the guy that just cut you off, because it's like, okay, that doesn't change anything in the way I'm driving right now. That doesn't change anything in the way that I'm getting from A to B. Yeah. Could be standing in line at the supermarket, keeping your 1.5 meters of distance, at least.
For me right now, it's working with my 2 very male roommates who leave crumbs all over the goddamn counter in the kitchen that I have to clean up at least twice a day, because we just have no sense of cleanliness in quarantine.
There's actually a pretty good book called Killing Mindfully. Achtsam Mördern, something like that, I think. You should read
Mindful
that.
Murder. Excellent.
Yeah. So you see, the applications of mindfulness range.
Yeah, they're very broad.
They spread very widely.
Hey, high performance is high performance.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about acceptance, because you work specifically in a mindful acceptance approach. Now, acceptance is obviously a huge part of meditation, which... that's a word that I tend not to use with athletes. They tend to think that it's very Zen, Buddhist, frou-frou shit. Like, it's actually not. We don't. John Kabat-Zinn said that it's a mindfulness is basically a very irreverent form of Buddhist meditation practice. So that's kind of what we're using. However, it could still be considered a meditation. So the keys of that are acceptance, letting things go, and non-judgment, and there's a bunch of other ones in our protocol that we use, but those three being main ones, and self-compassion as well. Can you go into specifically why this attention and acceptance is important?
Well, acceptance is, I think being mindful without being accepting is possible, because if you're being mindful and focusing on the present moment, the moment you're not accepting your internal states as part of the experience that you're having in the present moment, mm-hmm. you're getting distracted and pulled forward into the future or pulled backwards into the past. And so acceptance is super important insofar as to minimize the effect that internal states have on your actions, mm-hmm. right, on your options of actions. And it's also a skill that can be practiced. I think acceptance is one of the harder parts of mindfulness, because it's super, super fucking hard. Sorry, I don't know if I'm allowed to swear.
Totally fine.
Okay. It's super fucking hard.
It is hard.
To not judge things, because evolutionarily, right, there are two main functions of our brains. We're supposed to be staying alive, and we're supposed to spread our genes, right? Procreate, as God intended.
And anybody who's in quarantine can definitely say that that's what they've been thinking about. let's just be honest.
Survive and spread your genes, right?
Yeah.
And so being able to categorize or judge things very quickly is a super important evolutionary trait. And it has been, but it's not so much in the current, in the modern world. Sure, there are still things that, like, especially in Australia or whatever. I lived in Sri Lanka. Like, going through the jungle, there are things that you want to judge quickly, right?
Yeah.
Like, is that a branch or is it a poisonous snake? Oh, I don't know.
Yeah.
Oh, is it venomous, I think.
But it requires this constant alertness and on guardness, you mean?
Yes. Yeah. And there's basically a... learning to stop those automatic processes, those unconscious processes, is hard freaking work, and it takes time, and it takes a lot of time sort of dissecting your thoughts. And I think for acceptance, cognitive fusion is a very important topic, where basically we build through learning, because, you know, people learn, imagine that, we build connections between our thoughts, emotions, and bodily sensations. So it could be a situation of, whenever I notice that my hands are sweaty, I know that I'm nervous.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why is that? Do those two things really have to cause each other, or do you always have sweaty hands when you're nervous, or are you always nervous when you've got sweaty hands? And I think when you're getting into a point where you starting to try to loosen those connections, like applying cognitive defusion, as we call it, that's where we really get down to. At least for me, that was sort of a key point where I learned, okay, there are so many things that I assume about my own behavior, about my own emotions, about my own thoughts and experiences.
Yeah.
That distract me from acting mindfully, from acting in accordance with my values.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that as well, like cognitive fusion and defusion is hugely important for acceptance, like being able to interpret things that you're experiencing without judging them.
Yeah. Instead of having unconscious associations, like, So my biggest one, just to give a example, was after I left sport, we know soccer, like it's a generally moderate heart rate, because you're pretty much jogging and then sprinting here and there. So you might have small spikes, but then it returns to a moderate heart rate, say.
Yep.
But generally speaking, my heart rate was very low. Beats per minute, I think 68. Like, most people were like, are you dead? How are you living? Like, it's very...
Is this resting or while playing?
Resting, yeah.
Okay.
So, while playing about 100, and then while sprinting 120, something like that, but relatively not extreme. And so after I left sport, I started having issues with anxiety, and that was pretty much the only time that my heart rate would spike was when I was having a panic attack or severe anxiety. So when my heart rate would spike, I had this unconscious association that I'm freaking out when I was actually doing a workout, like sprinting. Yeah. It actually took me away from wanting to sprint or do high intensity training, because I felt like I'm having a panic attack every single time. And even if I had no anxiety whatsoever, I would immediately shift into, oh my God, I'm freaking out, and having to unbuild or break down, defuse those diffusions were difficult. Like, and to do it not judgmentally instead of being like, you bitch, like, there's, you're not freaking out. Will you shut up already? And just self-kindness.
On the quiet corner, bitch.
Exactly. Hello, running commentary, peanut gallery. X out. Like, yeah, so I agree that it's very important. And we build those without ever thinking about them and ever considering them.
It's completely unconscious. It's like, it was like that for me. That was a huge step in my, I don't want to say injury recovery, because it wasn't recovery. It was more so like getting back to being able to train normally. Mm-hmm. So for those who don't know, I mean, I think I tell the story every time I'm here. Here we go. I had a protrusion, a disc protrusion, L5-S1, that was pinching a nerve. So I was out of training, basically out of training for like 6 months. And it's taken me, I mean, I'm still in the process of learning to not overinterpret signals that I'm getting from my body. So I'll like go, so I got hurt while squatting because I was a dumbass and didn't brace properly. And I was just like, oh, I want to get this over with. And so now every time I squat, I cannot squat without having feelings of fear, anxiety while squatting. Yeah. It just doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. So I'm having to learn, and I'm still in the process of that, of accepting that to be able to squat with it, right? Mm-hmm. Trusting the fact that, okay, it's been a long while. My disc is healed. Like, I can, my technique has improved. I've gotten stronger. Even if I'm feeling, and the sort of the difference between interpreting discomfort and pain has been the biggest barrier, because whenever I feel tension in my lower back, I immediately go, like the emotions just come flooding in. And I'm just like, okay, well, why am I doing this? Am I doing the right thing? Am I justified? And am I ever going to be able to walk as a grown up?
Yeah.
And all these fears come flooding in, and it's being able to stop, observe, take a breath, stop, take a breath, observe, and proceed.
I've gotten a few of those text messages from you. Yeah. I fucked my shoulder, God. And then the next morning it's like, it's fine. Like, I'm good.
Yeah. So sometimes like it needs that outburst to then be able to say, okay, let's take a step back. Let's reassess this properly. Give it a day. Just see how it feels tomorrow. And you'll most likely be fine.
And it's, but I think it's that goes to say it's like a very long, intense, multi-step process. Like, you can't start deciding that you're going to practice mindfulness and
for sure
get better at it overnight. It's a skill.
I think the fastest changes in sports and everyday life that I've seen have been within 2 to 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So two to three weeks is usually when people start noticing small changes.
Of deliberate practice, though, not just like bullshitting it three times a week. This is like
daily practice, daily reflecting on things that you've done, taking time to be mindful throughout the day, not just while you're doing your meditation.
Yeah.
So you have to be very vigilant with that sort of stuff.
And I want to come back to the concept of practice, but first I want to go back to pain and give kind of the breakdown of the neuroscience of pain and meditation. So basically what they found in a couple studies that they run on people who meditate versus people who don't meditate is that it frees up the limbic system, which is essentially where, like, the emotional base. Yeah. So obviously the sensory system can tell us if we have pain or not. That's what alerts our nervous system. Mm-hmm. Hey, you know, I touched the stove and I got to pull my hand back.
Yeah.
That's what send and receive in the brain sends the, sends the signal back to the body, hey, pull your hand back really fast. And it happens without us obviously ever thinking about it deliberately. It's just an unconscious, involuntary process. But the limbic system is where we, like the amygdala and hippocampus, is where we get that running peanut gallery commentary about, oh, now my hand is ruined. Or for you, it's...
my career as a hand model is over. Yeah,
exactly. For you, it's, I'm never going to be able to walk again. I'm blah, 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 blah. So people who meditate, they found, actually have a higher threshold because they don't have that running commentary. So they have a higher threshold of being able to experience pain and discomfort, and it doesn't bother them as much in the process. Like, they're actually feeling more pain, like having a higher subjective experience of pain, but they're not feeling it.
yeah.
as severely as the people who basically have that peanut gallery. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, my life is over.
Yep.
And that makes it a lot easier to go through life when you're not taking up mental real estate and worrying about, you know, if everything you've done in your life is is going to make you a failure and disappoint your family and bring dishonor to your name. And it helps everything. Yeah, but that's the same in sports performance. Again, that ability to not over control things and activate the frontal lobe and just be like, my brain has already automated this. I know the sensations are telling me that this is painful or that this is a high stakes situation or that this really matters. Let me turn off the peanut gallery. Sometimes we can't turn it off. The good thing is that we just learn to be a spectator to our own brain.
Yeah.
Kind of just like you're watching clouds in the sky pass by. You can't stop them. Just say, oh, you're pretty. Notice them and move on. Yeah. And that's the acceptance non-judgmentally in a particular way.
I think one way, so I know we did the whole cognitive diffusion thing. And one of the techniques that I really like, so there's different ones, different stages of cognitive diffusion that you can go through. Mm-hmm. And the very first one that I use, or the very first one also that my athletes use, is being thankful for the brain, or to the, being thankful to the brain for alerting you to something that could potentially disrupt your chances to survive or procreate.
Yeah, it's always trying to save your life.
I like to imagine sort of my brain as a someone that has a phobia of everything. It's like,
no, don't do it. Your brain's just sitting there like
everything is dangerous.
Yeah, totally.
And be sort of being a caring parent, you know, that's super experienced and it's, you're fine.
Helicopter.
It's all right. You're doing okay. Nothing's gonna happen to you.
Yeah.
Thanks for warning me, though. I appreciate that. And that sort of takes some of the stimulus off of it.
Yeah,
right? It sort of flattens the curve, to make a to make a very current metaphor.
I can't wait for people in like 2030 to look back on all these podcasts and shows and Instagram captions and be like, "What were they talking about?"
I think they'll remember. I think this is going to be remembered for a while.
Yeah. But people who don't live through it or remember it won't remember how absolutely terrifying it was to live through and how much mindfulness is needed. All right, so let's go into the process. Speaking of that, what is for you the process of putting mindfulness into practice? Again, it's not something we can learn overnight. Mm-hmm. So how does it work?
I'm a proponent of viewing it as just as any other sports skill that you would learn or acquire. So we're talking about building a base. We're talking about taking your time to master the fundamentals. And we're then talking about long-term development in different areas. So the way I do it in my book as well is you start off with a short, I call it sort of an attention task, right? Rather than a meditation, which is like a 5-minute exercise that has you focusing on different things, including the reason why you're doing it and what sort of your doubts are about doing it or whatever. Mm-hmm. And you do that every single day. I also have people start to do like a gratefulness box. Is that good? Gratitude box, where they write down 3 things that they're grateful for every single day. Small things, not like I'm grateful for, or I'm grateful that I can breathe. But more so things like I'm grateful for that baller Nutella sandwich I had this morning, because that shit is dope. And then we take that foundation of, okay, you're now learning to focus within 5-minute stints of time. And then after a week or two, you expand that by adding a 10-minute attention exercise or a 10-minute meditation. And then you start, when you've done that for a couple of weeks and you've done that sort of 3, 4, 5 times a week, we start to vary it by including sort of daily tasks. So now you're trying to mindfully wash dishes, or mindfully brush your teeth, or mindfully clean your flat or whatever. So now you're incorporating that mindfulness that we've built in sort of a relaxed state where you're meditating on your own without too much external stimulus. And we're applying that to movement, right? Mm-hmm. And it should be everyday movements. Once we've done that for a while, we then start to look mindfully at the movements that we're doing in the sport. And that's very sport specific. Mm-hmm. And then we're starting to apply the skills, the foundational skills that we've built up over time to the sport itself. And it's a long process. I think sort of 5 to 6 weeks is the shortest amount of time you could accomplish that in a way where it's giving you an actual benefit rather than sort of disrupting some of your current performance routines, which can happen at the start. Mm-hmm. But I think that sort of long-term approach where you then, so then when you've applied it to your sport and you set your anchors and stuff, you then start to increase the complexity, and you can vary the complexity of the exercise. So you could try doing the 10-minute meditation while you're on the train to work, or yeah, while you're in a meeting, right?
Been there, done that.
Or you could do it for longer. You could do it more time. So we're talking about intensity, frequency, and volume, right?
Yeah.
Just the same as we would with training. And so I think that's a very good way of looking at it, sort of as a long-term process of skill acquisition in sports.
Why gratitude?
Because it helps dampen the negative stimuli that we get from our perception when we're being mindful. So when you're being mindful, especially with thoughts, some people, especially in sports, you know, high rate of perfectionism and what have you, yeah, people tend to have a lot of negative self-talk or a lot of negative thoughts.
Mood.
Yeah. And learning to be grateful for smaller things, actually, and we know this actually makes a difference in sort of the neurophysiological constructs, yeah, that we have, right? So we look at, I think was it fMRI scans, mm-hmm, or MRI scans of brains of Buddhist monks versus normal people.
Yeah.
And there are actual physiological differences in the brain caused by long-term gratefulness and meditation. So it dampens the effect that some of that negative self-talk or negative perception of emotions can have by introducing more positive ones. Because when you start gratefulness, like when you start writing down those three things that you're grateful for, it might be hard to come up with different things every single day. After a while, what you should notice is that as you're going through your day, you'll perceive things that you can write down, and you'll be like, oh, I'll note that down tonight. I'll put that on my note tonight. And after a couple of weeks, you'll instantly be able to write down more than three things every night.
Yeah.
You're having to choose between things to write down.
Yeah.
So it changes our perception and sort of balances out the negative and the positive a little bit and makes it easier to go about it with acceptance.
Yeah, I love that. And gratefulness is a huge part of my meditation and mindfulness practice as well. It changes a lot. And I want to go back to the concept of faking it until you make it, mm-hmm, if that applies in meditation. Because what I hear very often from athletes, whether I'm working with them in sports psych or if they're, mm-hmm, working with a psychologist and just trying to implement some of these things, is I feel like I can't do it and I don't know where to start. And I follow the concept of you literally have to fake it and force yourself to do it until you become comfortable with doing it. Why is it so uncomfortable and how do we start doing it?
I think it's uncomfortable because it's just something that, especially in our cultural hemisphere of the West, mm-hmm, it's not something that we're brought up doing, right? Like being, yeah, great, especially in Germany, Germans love complaining. Being negative is like the German way of life. everything sucks, and here's the reason why. So it's not something that we're used to. It's completely new. It's like a completely different worldview as well. So there's a high amount of cognitive dissonance that comes with it when you start off. Mm-hmm. But the funny thing about it is that it's fine. It's fine to have that experience. It's fine to feel uncomfortable doing it. Being mindful, like the moment you notice that you're feeling uncomfortable, you're being mindful of the present moment.
Yeah,
the moment you're saying, right now, I'm feeling uncomfortable and this is stressing me out, congratulations, you've been mindful by noticing those feelings. Yeah.
Or the moment thoughts that you realize that your thoughts are totally distracted from your, yeah, breathing or from where you were going mentally, that you've already won by, yeah, noticing it.
Yeah.
Because it's the nature of the mind to wander constantly.
Yeah. So it's not something, I think it's to trying to learn a specific new movement that was really challenging, right?
Yeah.
Like if you put me on some gymnastics bars,
forget it.
Like, it would take me months Even now, it would probably take me months to be able to do a proper muscle up, right? As an example.
Easily.
Mostly because I'm fat, but...
it would also rip out your shoulder.
There's other reasons, right? But speaking in terms of motor skills, it would probably take me a long time. And use that same approach to learning to be mindful, because it is a long process. It's not something that's just going to happen overnight. You will start noticing progress after a couple of weeks, but it will take a long time before you will notice it actually making a difference in your sports performance or your everyday life. As I said, the quickest I've seen it make differences was after, like, I think 2 or 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. But that was someone who was really training intensively every single day.
Last question, because I think I've heard this several times and it is fascinating to me. People who are scared of mindfulness and meditation, what can they do? People who struggle to get into it because they feel things come up that maybe need to come up or are already there. But because mindfulness is this quieting of the mind and acceptance and non-judgment of whatever comes, what would you say to, what can people do who are scared of those things coming up?
I mean, genuinely, there, you might not like this answer.
Nobody likes the answer I give anyway, so hoping you have a better one.
No, I actually, because I've talked about this with a therapist. I've talked to a therapist extensively about mindfulness techniques and their application in therapy.
Same.
And I think for people who are having a genuinely adverse reaction to mindfulness, where they're like starting to cry and break down and stuff, your ass needs to go to therapy.
Yeah, it's in there anyway. So,
like if mindfulness or meditation is actually causing you to break down psychologically, and have panic attacks or have crying fits or whatever, there are some underlying issues that you need to go take care of. And I think there's no need to downplay that. I think in that sense, mindfulness can even be useful in forcing you to realize that there's stuff going on that you need to be dealing with rather than putting it off for longer periods of time. So I think, I know that mindfulness practices have been used in clinical settings extensively, right? We know that there's things like acceptance commitment therapy that work really well. I've actually worked on designing some acceptance commitment therapy programs. And we know that they work well in all sorts of contexts. It doesn't matter, like even from depression to schizophrenia, the application it makes sense and it's useful and it does make a difference.
I've also worked on cognitive-based or mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Yeah. It is really useful, but
we're talking about, especially in terms of studies that prove the usefulness of these methods. We're talking about people who are already aware that they need help.
Yeah, and they're done in a therapeutic setting,
exactly,
with the guidance of a therapist.
Yes, and so I think if you're someone who's experiencing that kind of a reaction, then that's probably a step that you need to take anyway.
Yeah.
Which doesn't mean that you can't combine the two, right? Yeah. But in terms of sports performance, I think sports performance in the second you notice that happening, sports performance takes a huge step back in terms of priority.
Yeah. Couldn't agree more. I tend to say that, first of all, again, there's layers to everything. So if you're feeling things come up, that's because they're already there. Okay, yeah. Mindfulness doesn't create something that isn't there. It just makes you more aware and less judgmental about what is there and helps you sort through it, but only sort through it if there's things that you need to, barriers you need to push through or things you need to unbuild. Mindfulness can help you do that, but it's not the only thing that will help you do that. And you need to do that safely with the guidance and supervision of a professional. But it's also worth noting that a lot of people in their first steps of mindfulness and meditation do start feeling uncomfortable emotions because it's very hard to sit with your own emotions and name them. And we tend to distract constantly throughout the day. So when you get to the point of accepting distractions and redirecting and purposefully working through these feelings, these emotions, these thoughts, whatever they may be, and sitting there with them, instead of just being like, okay, I'm going to go game for 6 hours and dissociate, or I'm going to, you know, we don't like to be uncomfortable. It's human nature to not want to be uncomfortable. But a lot of people do stress out when they start feeling things that are uncomfortable because it's hard to sit with your own emotions. We don't do that as a society. Yeah. So don't overthink it too much. Give it a bit of time to, it does become easier over time. Again, it's a skill, but it will be uncomfortable at first. And if you feel like there's things coming up where you just can't get into it because you're repeatedly breaking down, then you do need to seek professional help. This isn't the only thing that will help that.
Yeah.
It's just a tool.
Truth.
Yeah, man, that was awesome. I think let's end it there. I'm always so grateful for your input. So thanks for coming back and sharing your professional knowledge. Tell us where we can find you and where people can get their hands on, the Germans can get their hands on the Mackie book.
You can find me on Instagram at Fundamentalkraft or Fundamental Craft with a K. Or www.fundamentalkraft.de.
We love double meanings.
Yes. And that's also where you can find my ebook, which is out since Saturday. Go check it out. It's sort of I don't want to be like an opportunist because of Corona, but it is actually a really good time to be starting that sort of training program.
Oh, hell yeah.
Psychological training program when you're having time off anyway and your ability to train is limited, because it will give you a really good foundation for when you're coming back.
And let me just say that everybody who thinks that we're just going to step back out on the platform or on the pitch after all this is over without a problem, you're fucking wrong. Everybody's going to be so traumatized when we go back. Like, let's just accept it. It is what it is. It's going to be really hard to go back when we aren't able to. And having a good solid foundation of mental skills to help you get through the transition back to normal life is going to be extremely helpful. So I couldn't agree more. Perfect. Everybody's going to need therapy for like 6 months after this.
I mean, I've already thought about volunteering. So there.
So. Same. Same.
All right. Thank you for having me. It's always a blast every time.
Always.
I miss your face.
I miss your face. And I'm always happy to have your input and talk to you about whether it's bullshit or not. So.